and the bets weren't doing very well. It turned out that the error came down to a single misplaced character in 10,000 lines of code. His assistant had mistakenly coded the Phillies' home ballpark, Citizens Bank Park, a compact field that boosts offense and home runs, as PH1 rather than PHI. That one line of code had been enough to swamp the signal in his program and tie up Vulgaris's capital in betting on the noise. Vulgaris was so dismayed by the bug that he stopped using his baseball betting program entirely. The challenge for Campbell is that Deep Blue long ago became better at chess than its creators. It might make a move that they wouldn't have played, but they wouldn't necessarily know if it was a bug. In the early stages of debugging Deep Blue, when it would make a move that was unusual, I would say, "Oh, there's something wrong," Campbell told me. We dig in and look at the code and eventually figure out what the problem was. But that happened less and less as time went on. As it continued to make these unusual moves, we'd look in and see that it had figured out something that is difficult for humans to see. Perhaps the most famous moves in chess history were made by the chess prodigy Bobby Fischer in the so-called Game of the Century in 1956. Fischer, just 13 years old at the time, made two dramatic sacrifices in his game against the grandmaster Donald Byrne, at one point offering up a knight for no apparent gain, then a few moves later, deliberately leaving his queen unguarded to advance one of his bishops instead. Both moves were entirely right. The destruction that Fischer realized on Byrne from the strategic gain in his position became obvious just a few moves later. However, few grandmasters then or today would have considered Fischer's moves. Heuristics like never give up your queen except for another queen or an immediate checkmate are too powerful, probably because they serve a player well 99% of the time. When I put the positions into my mid-range laptop and ran them on the computer program Fritz, however, it identified Fischer's plays after just a few seconds. In fact, the program considers any moves other than the ones that Fischer made to be grievous errors. In searching through all possible moves, the program identified the situations where the heuristic should be discarded. We should probably not describe the computer as creative for finding the moves. Instead, it did so more through the brute force of its calculation speed. But it also had another advantage. It did not let its hang-ups about the right way to play chess get in the way of identifying the right move in those particular circumstances. For a human player, this would have required the creativity and confidence to see beyond the conventional thinking. People marveled at Fischer's skill because he was so young. But perhaps it was for exactly that reason that he found the moves. He had the full breadth of his imagination at his disposal. The blind spots in our thinking are usually of our own making, and they can grow worse as we age. Computers have their blind spots as well. But they can avoid these failures of the imagination by at least considering all possible moves. Nevertheless, there were some bugs in Deep Blue's inventory. Not many, but a few. Toward the end of my interview with him, Campbell somewhat mischievously referred to an incident that had occurred toward the end of the first game in their 1997 match with Kasparov. A bug occurred in the game, and it may have made Kasparov misunderstand the capabilities of Deep Blue, Campbell told me. He didn't come up with the theory that the move that it played was a bug. The bug had arisen on the 44th move of their first game against Kasparov. Unable to select a move, the program had defaulted to a last resort failsafe in which it picked a play completely at random. The bug had been inconsequential, coming late in the game in a position that had already been lost. Campbell and team repaired it the next day. We had seen it once before in a test game played earlier in 1997 and thought that it was fixed, he told me. Unfortunately, there was one case that we had missed. In fact, the bug was anything but unfortunate for Deep Blue. It was likely what allowed the computer to beat Kasparov. In the popular recounting of Kasparov's match against Deep Blue, it was the second game in which his problems originated, when he had made the almost unprecedented error of forfeiting a position that he could probably have drawn. But what had inspired Kasparov to commit this mistake? His anxiety over Deep Blue's 44th move in the first game. The move in which the computer had moved its rook for no apparent purpose. Kasparov had concluded that the counterintuitive play must be a sign of superior intelligence. He had never considered that it was simply a bug. For as much as we rely on 21st century technology, we still have Edgar Allan Poe's blind spots about the role that these machines play in our lives. The computer had made Kasparov blink, but only because of a design flaw. What computers do well? Computers are very, very fast at making calculations. Moreover, they can be counted on to calculate faithfully without getting tired or emotional or changing their mode of analysis in midstream. But this does not mean that computers produce perfect forecasts or even necessarily good ones. The acronym GIGO, Garbage In, Garbage Out, sums up this problem. If you give a computer bad data or devise a foolish set of instructions for it to analyze, it won't spin straw into gold. Meanwhile, computers are not very good at tasks that require creativity and imagination, like devising strategies or developing theories about the way the world works. Computers are most useful to forecasters, therefore, in fields like weather forecasting and chess, where the system abides by relatively simple and well-understood laws, but where the equations that govern the system must be solved many times over in order to produce a good forecast. They seem to have helped very little in fields like economic or earthquake forecasting, where our understanding of root causes is blurrier and the data is noisier. In each of those fields, there were high hopes for computer-driven forecasting in the 1970s and 1980s when computers became more accessible to everyday academics and scientists. But little progress has been made since then. Many fields lie somewhere in between these two poles. The data is often good, but not great, and we have some understanding of the systems and processes that generate the numbers, but not a perfect one. In cases like these, it may be possible to improve predictions through the process that Deep Blue's programmers used, trial and error. This is at the core of business strategy for the company we most commonly associate with big data today. When trial and error works. Visit the Googleplex in Mountain View, California, as I did in late 2009, and it isn't always clear when somebody is being serious and when they're joking around. It's a culture that fosters creativity, with primary colors, volleyball courts, and every conceivable form of two-wheeled vehicle. Google people, even its engineers and economists, can be whimsical and offbeat. "There are these experiments running all the time," said Hal Varian, the chief economist at Google, when I met him there. "You should think of it as more of an organism, a living thing. I have said that we should be concerned about what happens when it comes alive, like Skynet. But we made a deal with the governor of California, at the time Arnold Schwarzenegger, to come and aid us." Google performs extensive testing on Search and its other products. "We ran 6,000 experiments on Search last year, and probably another 6,000 or so on the ad monetization side," he said. "So Google is doing on a rough order of 10,000 experiments a year. Some of these experiments are highly visible, occasionally involving rolling out a whole new product line. But most are barely noticeable, moving the placement of a logo by a few pixels or slightly permuting the background color on an advertisement, and then seeing what effect that has on click-throughs or monetization. Many of the experiments are applied to as few as 0.5% of Google's users, depending on how promising the idea seems to be. When you search for a term on Google, you probably don't think of yourself as participating in an experiment. But from Google's standpoint, things are a little different. The search results that Google returns, and the order in which they appear on the page, represent their prediction about which results you will find most useful. How is a subjective-seeming quality like usefulness measured and predicted? If you search for a term like best new Mexican restaurant, does that mean you are planning a trip to Albuquerque? That you were looking for a Mexican restaurant that opened recently? That you want a Mexican restaurant that serves Nuevo Latino cuisine? You probably should have formed a better search query. But since you didn't, Google can convene a panel of 1,000 people who made the same request, show them a wide variety of web pages, and have them rate the utility of each one on a scale of 0 to 10. Then Google would display the pages to you in order of the highest to lowest average rating. Google cannot do this for every search request, of course, not when they receive hundreds of millions of search requests per day. But, Varian told me, they do use human evaluators on a series of representative search queries. Then they see which statistical measurements are best correlated with these human judgments about relevance and usefulness. Google's best-known statistical measurement of a website is PageRank, a score based on how many other web pages link to the one you might be seeking out. But PageRank is just one of 200 signals that Google uses to approximate the human evaluator's judgment. Of course, this is not such an easy task. 200 signals apply to an almost infinite array of potential search queries. This is why Google places so much emphasis on experimentation and testing. The product you know as Google Search, as good as it is, will very probably be a little bit different tomorrow. What makes the company successful is the way it combines this rigorous commitment to testing with its freewheeling creative culture. Google's people are given every inducement to do what people do much better than computers. Come up with ideas. A lot of ideas. Google then harnesses its immense data to put these ideas to the test. The majority of them are discarded very quickly, but the best ones survive. Computer programs play chess in this way, exploring almost all possible options in at least some depth, but focusing their resources on the more promising lines of attack. It is a very Bayesian process. Google is always at a running start, refining its search algorithms, never quite seeing them as finished. In most cases, we cannot test our ideas as quickly as Google, which gets feedback more or less instantaneously from hundreds of millions of users around the world. Nor do we have access to a supercomputer, as Deep Blue's engineers did. Progress will occur at a much slower rate. Nevertheless, a commitment to testing ourselves, actually seeing how well our predictions work in the real world, rather than in the comfort of a statistical model, is probably the best way to accelerate the learning process. Overcoming our technological blind spot. In many ways, we are our greatest technological constraint. The slow and steady march of human evolution has fallen out of step with technological progress. Evolution occurs on millennial timescales, whereas processing power doubles roughly every other year. Our ancestors who lived in caves would have found it advantageous to have very strong, perhaps almost hyperactive, pattern recognition skills, to be able to identify in a split second whether that rustling in the leaves over yonder was caused by the wind or by an encroaching grizzly bear. Nowadays, in a fast-paced world awash in numbers and statistics, those same tendencies can get us into trouble. When presented with a series of random numbers, we see patterns where there aren't any. Advertisers and politicians, possessed of modern guile, often prey on the primordial parts of our brain. Chess, however, makes for a happy ending. Kasparov and Deep Blue's programmers saw each other as antagonists, but they each taught us something about the complementary roles that computer processing speed and human ingenuity can play in prediction. In fact, the best game of chess in the world right now might be played neither by man nor machine. In 2005, the website chessbase.com hosted a freestyle chess tournament. Players were free to supplement their own insight with any computer program or programs that they liked, and to solicit advice over the internet. Although several grandmasters entered the tournament, it was won neither by the strongest human players nor by those using the most highly regarded software, but by a pair of 20-something amateurs from New Hampshire, Stephen Crampton and Zachary Zach S. Stephen, who surveyed a combination of three computer programs to determine their moves. Crampton and Stephen won because they were neither awed nor intimidated by technology. They knew the strengths and weaknesses of each program and acted less as players than as coaches. Be wary, however, when you come across phrases like, the computer thinks the Yankees will win the World Series. If these are used as shorthand for a more precise phrase, the output of the computer program is that the Yankees will win the World Series, they may be totally benign. With all the information in the world today, it's certainly helpful to have machines that can make calculations much faster than we can. But if you get the sense that the forecaster means this more literally, that he thinks of the computer as a sentient being, or the model as having a mind of its own, it may be a sign that there isn't much thinking going on at all. Whatever biases and blind spots the forecaster has are sure to be replicated in his computer program. We have to view technology as what it always has been, a tool for the betterment of the human condition. We should neither worship at the altar of technology nor be frightened by it. Nobody has yet designed, and perhaps no one ever will, a computer that thinks like a human being. But computers are themselves a reflection of human progress and human ingenuity. It is not really artificial intelligence if a human designed the artifice. Chapter 10. The Poker Bubble. The year 2003 was the start of the poker boom, a sort of bubble economy in which the number of new and inexperienced players was growing exponentially, and even a modicum of poker skill could be parlayed into large profits. The phenomenon had two immediate and related causes. One was the 2003 World Series of Poker in Las Vegas, which was won by a 27-year-old amateur, a Nashville accountant with the auspicious name of Chris Moneymaker. Moneymaker was the literal embodiment of the poker everyman, a slightly pudgy office drone who, through a never-ending series of daring bluffs and lucky draws, had turned the $39 he paid to enter an online qualifying tournament into a $2.5 million purse. ESPN turned Moneymaker's achievement into a six-part miniseries, played on nearly continuous repeat on weekday evenings until baseball season finally came along to fill the void. It was terrific advertising for the sport of poker, which until that time had a reputation for being seedy, archaic, and intimidating. Suddenly, every balding 5'8" accountant who had long ago given up on his dream of being the next Michael Jordan or Derek Jeter could see in Moneymaker someone who looked just like him, who had a job just like his, and who in a matter of weeks had gone from rank amateur to the winner of the biggest poker tournament in the world. But the ESPN broadcasts presented a highly sanitized version of what reality actually looks like at the poker table. For one thing, out of the necessity of compressing more than 40 hours of play involving more than 800 players into 6 hours of broadcasts, they showed only a small fraction of the hands as they were actually played. What's more, because of the ingenious invention of the hole cam, pinhole-sized cameras installed around the edge of the table beside each player, the cards of not just Moneymaker, but those of each of his opponents were revealed to the home audience as the hand was being played out, giving the audience the feeling of being clairvoyant. Poker is a pretty easy game if you know what cards your opponent holds. Moneymaker was cast as the protagonist who could do no wrong. Hands that a sober analysis might have concluded he'd played poorly were invariably praised by the announcers. Rash bluffs became gutsy ones. Premature folds became perceptive ones. Moneymaker was not some slightly above average schmo getting the cards of his life, but a poker savant who was cunning enough to have developed into a world-class player almost overnight. The viewer was led to believe that poker is easy to learn, easy to profit from, and incredibly action-packed, none of which is true. But that didn't stop many of them from concluding that only a ticket to Las Vegas separated them from life as the next Chris Moneymaker. The number of participants in the World Series of Poker's $10,000 main event exploded, from 839 the year that Moneymaker won it to 8,773 just 3 years later. I was one of those people. I lived the poker dream for a while, and then it died. I learned that poker sits at the muddy confluence of the signal and the noise. My years in the game taught me a great deal about the role that chance plays in our lives and the delusions it can produce when we seek to understand the world and predict its course. The start of a poker dream. The other catalyst of the poker boom was the internet. Internet poker had existed in some form since 1998, but it began to go mainstream in 2003 as companies like Party Poker and Poker Stars became more aggressive about marketing their way through the legal quagmire of internet gambling. Players from all around the world flocked to the online games, overcoming their reservations about the security and legality of the virtual card rooms. They offered a whole host of conveniences, 24/7 access to every form of poker, at stakes ranging from pennies a hand to hundreds of dollars, a faster-paced experience. A computer chip can shuffle much faster than a human dealer can, and there's no need to tip it. The comfort of playing from home rather than at a smoky, decrepit casino. I had a job not unlike moneymakers, as I described earlier, working as an economic consultant for the accounting firm KPMG. One of my buddies at work suggested that we start a regular game, gambling just enough to make ourselves nervous. I had a smidgen of poker experience, having made a few four-in-the-morning sojourns to the Soaring Eagle Indian Casino in Mount Pleasant, Michigan. But I was rusty and needed practice and began to look online. A clunky, buggy site named Pacific Poker was making players an offer that was hard to refuse. $25 in real money poker chips with almost no strings attached. I lost the initial $25 fairly quickly. But the players in the Pacific Poker games did not seem much more sophisticated than the mix of ex-convicts and septuagenarians who populated the games at the Soaring Eagle. So I deposited $100 of my own. Almost all professional poker players begin their careers on winning streaks. The ones that lose at first are usually sensible enough to quit. And I was no exception. My bankroll began to grow, by $50 or $100 a night at first, and then sometimes by $500 or $1,000. After about 3 months, my winnings hit $5,000. I began staying up all night to play, taking a cab to work at the crack of dawn and faking my way through the workday. After 6 months and $15,000 in winnings, I quit my job, leaving the exciting world of international tax consulting behind to split my time between playing cards and working for Baseball Prospectus. It was liberating. I felt as though I'd hacked the system somehow. I have no idea whether I was really a good player at the very outset. But the bar set by the competition was low, and my statistical background gave me an advantage. Poker is sometimes perceived to be a highly psychological game, a battle of wills in which opponents seek to make perfect reads on one another by staring into one another's souls, looking for tells that reliably betray the contents of the other hands. There is a little bit of this in poker, especially at the higher limits, but not nearly as much as you'd think. The psychological factors in poker come mostly in the form of self-discipline. Instead, poker is an incredibly mathematical game that depends on making probabilistic judgments amid uncertainty, the same skills that are important in any type of prediction. How poker players predict hands. Good poker players are not distinguished by their ability to predict which cards will come next, as though they had ESP. Only the most superstitious or paranoid players believe that the order of the shuffle is anything other than random. Only the very worst ones will have failed to commit the most basic odds calculations to memory. That a flush has about a 1 in 3 chance of coming in with 2 cards to come, or that a pair of aces will beat a pair of kings about 80% of the time. The core analytic skill, rather, is what players call hand reading, in figuring which cards your opponent might hold and how they might affect her decision throughout the rest of the hand. This is an extremely challenging problem, especially in Texas Hold'em, the most commonly played variant of the game. In Hold'em, the cards are kept face down, and nothing is certain about an opponent's hand until all the bets are in and the pot is pushed someone's way. Each player begins the hand with one of 1,326 possible hand combinations. Everything from a majestic pair of aces to the lowly 7-deuce are among them, and nothing but the player's love of money prevents her from playing the one hand as though it is the other one. However, players can use their hand-reading skills to develop what amounts to a forecast of their opponent's likely range of hands. Poker players often talk about putting opponents on a hand, and sometimes they proceed as though they know exactly what two cards the opponent holds. But the best players always entertain numerous hypotheses, which they weigh and balance against the opponent's actions. A good poker forecast is probabilistic. It should become more precise as the hand is played out, but it is usually not possible to predict exactly which of the 1,326 possible hands your opponent holds until the cards are revealed, particularly if your opponent is skilled and is deliberately behaving unpredictably. Indeed, information is so hard to come by in Texas Hold'em that players begin to make estimates about their opponent's range of hands even before any of the cards are dealt. In online games, this is often done through data mining. You'll have statistics on how loose or tight, how passive or aggressive each opponent's play has been in previous games. In brick-and-mortar casinos, it is done through players' past histories with one another, or failing that, through what amounts to ethnic profiling. Players from Sweden, Lebanon, and China, for instance, have a reputation for being more aggressive than those from France, England, or India. Younger players are presumed to be looser and more aggressive than older ones. Men are assumed to be more likely to bluff than women. These stereotypes, like any others, are not always true. At the Hold'em games I used to play in at the Bellagio in Las Vegas, the best players were very often women, and they were good in part because they were much more aggressive than their opponents assumed. But poker players don't have the time for political correctness. Even if the stereotype that women play more conservatively than men is false 45% of the time, the fact that it might be true 55% of the time gives them something to work with. Once the game begins, these crude assumptions are supplanted by more reliable information. How the player has played previous hands at the table that day, and how she is playing this one. The process is fundamentally and profoundly Bayesian, with each player updating their probabilistic assessments after each bet, check, and call. If you doubt the practical uses of Bayes' theorem, you have probably never witnessed a poker game. A quick primer on Texas Hold'em. It is easy to access the rules of Texas Hold'em online or in other books, but I'll point out a few basics for the uninitiated to introduce you to the terminology used in the next few pages. These rules are simple compared with those of other card games. But much as is the case in chess, the relatively simple rules create a game with exceptional tactical and strategic depth. The game begins when two personal cards, called down cards or hole cards, are dealt face down to each player. A round of betting ensues at this stage. These personal cards then start to be combined with a series of community cards, also called the board, that are dealt face up and shared between all players at the table. Each player seeks to formulate his best five-card poker hand between his down cards and the community cards. The community cards are revealed sequentially, with a round of betting separating each stage. The first three cards are revealed simultaneously and are called the flop, one of the many pieces of colorful vocabulary that poker players use. The fourth community card, called the turn, is revealed next. Finally, the last card, the river, is exposed, and a final round of betting takes place. More often than not, all players but one will have folded by this point. If not, the player's down cards are finally flipped face up, and the best hand at the showdown wins the pot. The ranking of poker hands goes thus: a straight flush, four of a kind, a full house, a flush, a straight, three of a kind or a set, two pair, one pair, an unpaired high card. Otherwise tied hands are awarded to the player with the highest ranking cards. For instance, an ace-high flush beats a nine-high flush. When pairs are of the same rank, the tie is broken by the third highest card, or kicker. For example, the hand eight of hearts, eight of spades, king of clubs, seven of hearts, five of hearts, beats the hand eight of hearts, eight of spades, queen of diamonds, seven of hearts, six of spades, since the kicker is a king rather than a queen. A not-so-simple poker hand. Say that you're playing in a $5, $10 no-limit hold'em game at the Bellagio. The first few players fold, and you find yourself looking at some decent cards, a pair of eights, eight of spades, eight of clubs. So you raise to $25 and are called by just one player, a 60-something man whom we will call the lawyer. The lawyer is a nice guy, a little chatty in between hands, but quiet enough once the cards are dealt. We have learned that he has done fairly well for himself as a partner at an intellectual property law firm on the East Coast. You might imagine him wearing a polo shirt and periodically texting his friend to check on tea times. He had one beer when the cocktail waitress first came around before switching to coffee. He is not likely to be intimidated by these medium-sized stakes and isn't acting like it. When the lawyer first sat down at the table with us, we had been torn between two hypotheses about him. First, that he might be playing to show off a little, and therefore might make a few wild moves and bluffs. And second, that he might take a more legalistic and by-the-book approach. Our subsequent observation has confirmed that the latter profile is more likely to be correct. He seems to be a mediocre player, avoiding catastrophic errors, but without applying much finesse. The lawyer is by no means the worst player at the table, but he's probably not a long-term winner. Still, we haven't played against him for all that long and aren't completely sure about any of this. So what do we know about the lawyer's hand so far? The only thing we know absolutely without doubt is that he cannot hold any hands that contain the eight of spades or the eight of clubs, since those cards are in our hand. Unfortunately, that reduces the number of starting hand combinations only to 1,225 from 1,326, each of which was equally likely to be dealt when the hand began. However, the lawyer has given us some other information. He has chosen to call our bet. That means his hand is likely to be at least decent. Most players, including the lawyer, fold a clear majority of their hands against a raise before the flop. It also means he is unlikely to have an extremely strong hand like a pair of aces, since he called not just in lieu of folding, but also in lieu of re-raising, although this possibility cannot be discounted completely. We can start to form a probabilistic Bayesian assessment of what hands the lawyer might hold. From past experience with players like this, we know that his range of hands is likely to include pairs like nine of diamonds, nine of spades. It might include some hands with aces, especially if both cards are of the same suit, like the hand ace of hearts, five of hearts, meaning that it can more easily make flushes. Likewise, it might include what are called suited connectors, hands like six of spades, five of spades, that have consecutive cards of the same suit, and which can make both flushes and straights. Finally, he might call with hands that contain two face cards, like the king of clubs and the jack of diamonds. If we had enough time, we could enumerate the lawyer's hand range completely, with all 1,326 possibilities assigned a probability from 0% to 100%, given his actions so far. A computer, which can sort through the possibilities very quickly, might think about his play as a matrix. A matrix is far too complicated to keep track of under real-world conditions, however, so what players seek to do instead is break their opponent's hand range into different groupings that might function in about the same ways. In this case, the group of hands that would most concern us is if the lawyer began the hand with a pair higher than our eights. Fortunately, the probability of this is low. A player is blessed with a pair only rarely in hold'em. Indeed, when the cards are first dealt in hold'em, the chance of starting out with a pair of nines or better is only about 3%. However, we need to update our estimate of this probability because of his call. The lawyer is throwing out many of his worthless hands, increasing the chance that he has a strong one. According to our estimate, the chance he holds a pair higher than our eights has already risen to about 6% given how he has played the hand thus far. The other 94% of the time, the lawyer starts out with a worse hand than ours. The problem is that there are five cards still left to come, and while it is relatively hard for them to improve our pair, we would need to catch one of the two remaining eights in the deck, He could more easily make a higher pair, straight or flush. The lawyer takes a swig of coffee as the dealer arranges the flop cards on the center of the table. They consist of two clubs, a king and a three, along with a nine of hearts. These cards have not improved our hand. Our hope is that they have not improved the lawyer's either, in which case our pair of eights will still be best. So we make a relatively modest bet of $35 into the $65 pot. The lawyer pauses for a moment and calls. This call is not great news for us, as we can see by further refining our estimate of his hand range. The key, following Bayes' theorem, is to think in terms of conditional probabilities. For instance, if the lawyer started with a hand like King of Clubs, Jack of Diamonds, now giving him a pair of kings, how likely is it that he'd call us again? He'd almost certainly at least call having made top pair, but might he have raised instead? What about if he began the hand with a smaller pair than ours, like seven of hearts, seven of spades? How likely is it that he'd call rather than fold? If we had the luxury of time, we could go through all 1,326 hand combinations individually and revise our estimates accordingly. Our actual estimates at the table will not be quite as precise as this. Still, we can come to some broad probabilistic characterizations of his hand range given his call. About 30% of the time, the lawyer's hand connected strongly with a flop, and he has a pair of kings or better, a good hand that is unlikely to fold without a lot of pressure. There is also about a 20% chance that he has a pair worse than kings, but better than our eights. These hands beat ours as well, but the lawyer might be more likely to fold them later if we keep betting aggressively. Meanwhile, there's about a 25% chance that the lawyer has a draw to a straight or a flush, which is behind us for now, but has many ways to improve. Finally, there's a 25% chance that he has a worse pair than ours, or has almost nothing and is continuing in the hand solely in the hope of bluffing us later. These are the most favorable cases. You can see how complicated poker decisions become. Some of these possibilities imply that we should continue to bet our hand as aggressively as possible. Others imply we should take a more cautious approach, while still others would mean we should be preparing to fold. Just as we are contemplating this thorny decision, the dealer puts out the ideal card and makes our life easy. It is one of the two remaining eights in the deck, the eight of diamonds, giving us three of a kind. The only way we are beaten is if the lawyer started out with a pair of nines or a pair of kings and made a higher set on the flop, and has played them passively in order to trap us. Poker players term this slow playing. Still, we should not be thinking so defensively. In sorting through his possible hands, we should have the better one perhaps 98% of the time. So this time we make a relatively large bet, $100 into the $135 pot. The lawyer calls us once more. Because he is likely to have folded out his weaker pairs and weaker draws, we can now narrow his hand range even further. In fact, of the 1,326 hands that he might have started out with, not more than about 75 are all that likely at this stage. Often, he will have a pair of kings, a hand that we were previously worried about, but now beat. To the extent we are concerned, it's mostly about another club coming, which could still give him a flush. Instead, the final card is the harmless-looking five of spades, which does not complete the flush. King of clubs, nine of hearts, three of clubs, eight of diamonds, five of spades. We bet $250 into the $335 pot, hoping that the lawyer will call us with a worse hand. Suddenly, however, he springs to life. "I'm all in," he says to the dealer in a voice just barely louder than a whisper. He neatly pushes his remaining chips, about $1,200, into the pot. What the hell just happened? We now need to put our Bayesian thinking skills to the test. If our forecast of his hand range is off, we could easily make a $1,200 mistake. We look at the board and realize there is one exact hand, one from among the 1,326 random combinations, that seems most consistent with his play. The specific hand is a seven and a six of clubs. It is a suited connector, so we think he would have called with it before the flop. On the flop, this hand made a flush draw with four clubs, and we didn't bet enough to push him off it. On the turn, the hand missed its flush, but nevertheless became stronger. The eight of diamonds that made our hand three of a kind gave the lawyer the possibility of making a straight with any ten or five. If that was indeed his hand, the five of spades on the river made his straight, which beats our three of a kind and would explain why he is now betting so boldly. So should we fold? Even if you have never played poker, it is worth pausing for a moment to consider what you'd do. The answer is that you should very probably not fold. In fact, against many players, you should be pleased that more money is going into the pot. The solution comes from Bayes' theorem. It's true that the all-in bet is an extremely powerful move. It conveys much more information than his calls before. But before the lawyer went all-in, we would have assigned a very low probability, perhaps 1%, to his holding exactly the 7 and 6 of clubs, just one possible hand out of the myriad combinations. Unless we are extremely confident that the 7 of clubs, 6 of clubs is about the only hand that he'd make this play with, folding could be a huge mistake. Our hand only needs to be good about 35% of the time to make the call correct mathematically. In fact, there are some alternate possibilities for his hand. The lawyer could have a set of threes or possibly a set of fives, which still lose to our set of eights. He could plausibly have made two pair with a hand like King of Hearts, Five of Hearts. Some players would play a pair of aces in this way. In his Bayesian model of our hand range, the lawyer might reasonably figure that hands like this are better than ours, even though they are not, and he might be willing to get a lot of money in with them. There are also a couple of hands apart from the straight which would beat us. If the lawyer was slow playing a set of nines the whole way, or a set of kings, he'll now get our money. This is counterbalanced by the possibility of a complete bluff. If the lawyer had a flush draw that missed, the only way he can win the pot is by bluffing at it. As Arthur Conan Doyle once said, "Once you eliminate the impossible, whatever remains, no matter how improbable, must be the truth." This is sound logic, but we have a lot of trouble distinguishing the impossible from the highly improbable, and sometimes get in trouble when we try to make too fine a distinction. All of the opponent's hands are in some way highly improbable at this stage. This has been an unusual hand. It is a matter of weighing improbabilities against other improbabilities, and the calculation weighs against the hypothesis that he has 7 of clubs, 6 of clubs exactly. If we ran the possibilities through a computer, it might think there's something like a 2/3 probability that we still have the best hand. In practice, poker players might differ a lot in how they assess the probabilities for his hand. Skilled poker players are probably better than 99.9% of the population at making reasonably good probabilistic judgments under uncertainty. In fact, I don't know of a single game or intellectual exercise that better refines these skills. However, when I posted this hand on 2+2, an online forum for professional poker players, assessments ranged from that we were nearly certain to have the best hand to that we were nearly certain to be beat. My view is that both of these assessments are overconfident. We should not proceed as though we don't know anything about the opponent's hand, but in general, our predictive errors come in thinking that there is more certainty in the world than there really is. In this case, seeking to put the opponent on an exact hand would imply a fold, while a fuller assessment of the probabilities, coupled with the favorable odds from the pot, means that we should call instead. Schrödinger's poker hand. If this hand came up in a televised tournament on ESPN that showed us each player's hole cards, the analysis from the commentators might be different. They might assert that the fold was obvious if they knew that the opponent held 7 of clubs, 6 of clubs. In a parallel universe where the hand played out exactly the same way, but the opponent had 3 of hearts, 3 of spades instead, they'd tell us how thrilled we should be to get more money into the pot. In a televised game in 2009, two world-class players, Tom Dwan and Phil Ivey, played a hand in which the pot size eventually reached more than $1 million. In the hand, Ivey caught a miracle card on the turn to make him a 5-high straight. Unfortunately, the same card also gave Dwan a 7-high straight, the only possible better hand. "If anybody can get away from this, it's Phil Ivey," one of the announcers said, implying that it would be a sign of superior poker talent if he folded. In fact, throwing away the hand would have been a terrible play. Given what Ivey knew at the time and how aggressively he and Dwan play, he should have expected to have the best hand at least 90% of the time. If Ivey hadn't lost all his chips on the hand, he would have been playing badly. While television coverage has been a great boon to poker, it leaves many casual players with misleading impressions about the right way to play it, focusing too much on the results and not enough on the correct decision-making process. "It's not very common that you can narrow someone's holdings down to one hand," Dwan told me. "Definitely much less common than most pros and TV shows would have you believe." Making ourselves unpredictable. Dwan was once better known by his online screen name, Durr, which he selected because he figured it would put the other players on tilt if they lost to him. Dwan deposited $50 at the online site Full Tilt Poker at age 17, later dropping out of Boston College to play poker full-time. He rose through the ranks to become the apex predator in the online poker food chain. Millions of dollars flowed through him each month. Sometimes he lost it, but more often he won. By the time I spoke with him in 2012, Dwan was widely considered among the best no-limit hold'em players in the world. He has a reputation for being creative, aggressive, and most of all, fearless. In 2009, he challenged any player in the world, except for his close friend Phil Galfond, to play him head-to-head at very favorable odds. Three strong players eventually took him on, and Dwan won two of these matches. Yet for all his apparent bravado, Dwan is fairly low-key in person. His approach to thinking about poker and the world in general is highly probabilistic. He profits because his opponents are too sure of themselves. It's important in most areas of life to come up with a probability instead of a yes or no, he told me. It's a huge flaw that people make in a lot of areas that they analyze, whether they're trying to form a fiscal union, pay for groceries, or hoping that they don't get fired. Dwan seeks to exploit these tendencies by deliberately obfuscating his play. If the most important technical skill in poker is learning how to forecast your opponent's hand range, the next most important one is making your own play unpredictable. The better people are, the less certain you're going to be about what they have, or what they're doing, or what their range is, Dwan says, and they'll be more apt to manipulate that to take advantage of your judgments. While I'll never be the player that Dwan is, I took advantage of this in my own way during my days as a poker professional. In the soft online games of the mid-2000s, I could make money by playing conservative, tight poker. But I soon discovered that a more aggressive style could make me even more. The idea was to find the blind spots that my opponents might have in estimating my hand range. When you raise before the flop, for instance, the opponent will typically put you on big cards like those containing aces, kings, and queens. You will have those hands sometimes, of course. But I would also raise with hands like the ones we were worried about the lawyer having. Hands with small cards like 7 of clubs, 6 of clubs. What I found is that when big cards came on the board, like an ace or king, the opponent would often give me credit for catching those cards and fold. If smaller cards came instead, meanwhile, I'd often have made a pair or some kind of good draw. Sometimes I'd even make an unlikely seeming hand like a straight with these cards, which could send my opponents into tilt. One interesting thing about poker is that the very best players and the very worst ones both play quite randomly, although for different reasons. Thus, you can sometimes fool opponents into thinking you are a weak player, even if you are likely to take their money. Eventually, some of my opponents caught on to my more aggressive style, but this wasn't all bad. It meant that they were more likely to call down when I did have a predictable hand like a pair of kings, making these hands more profitable for me. In fact, bluffing and aggressive play is not just a luxury in poker, but a necessity. Otherwise, your play is just too predictable. Poker games have become extremely aggressive since I stopped playing regularly 5 years ago. And game theory, as well as computer simulations, strongly suggest this is the optimal approach. Blitzing your opponents with a deluge of possibilities is the best way to complicate his probability calculations. Sometimes you may also be able to identify situations where your opponent's intuitive estimates of the probabilities are too crude. Whenever a poker player thinks that his opponent might never play a certain hand in a certain way, never bluff in a certain situation, for instance, that's when you have the opportunity to exploit him by confusing his sense of the improbable and the impossible. There were a bunch of things I did that I knew were extremely suboptimal, but made me a really large amount of money for a long portion of time, Duan told me. It's only in the last few years people finally started realizing and getting better. Duan's main game, No Limit Hold'em, is especially fertile for such a strategy, because you potentially control, through the size of your bets, the amount of money at stake on each decision. Some choices that Duan makes involve no more than $100, while others might be for stakes of $10,000, $100,000, or even more. Make a few extra decisions right in million-dollar pots, and the collective sum of what you do for $100 at a time hardly matters at all. I mostly played Limit Hold'em instead, where the betting increment is fixed on each round. Until very recently, this was the most popular game outside of tournaments. 10 years ago, there were often no more than 2 or 3 no-limit games running anywhere in the United States. Limit poker offers fewer opportunities for creativity. Still, until practice caught up with theory, I had a couple of very successful years by exploiting an aggressive approach. In both 2004 and 2005, I made an income from poker in the 6 figures, with my cumulative profits from the game peaking at about $400,000 overall. The prediction learning curve. The difference between Duan and me is that while he is willing to take on almost literally any other player for any stakes at any time, I was merely in the upper middle class of poker players and needed to be in the game with some bad ones to be a favorite to make money. Fortunately, there were plenty of these bad players, what poker players call fish, during the poker boom years. There is a learning curve that applies to poker and to most other tasks that involves some type of prediction. The key thing about a learning curve is that it really is a curve. The progress we make at performing the task is not linear. Instead, it usually looks something like what I call the Pareto principle of prediction. What you'd see is a graph that consists of effort on one axis and accuracy on the other. You could label the axes differently. For instance, experience on the one hand and skill on the other. But the same general idea holds. By effort or experience, I mean the amount of money, time, or critical thinking that you are willing to devote toward a predictive problem. By accuracy or skill, I mean how reliable the predictions will prove to be in the real world. The name for the curve comes from the well-known business maxim called the Pareto Principle, or 80-20 rule, as in 80% of your profits come from 20% of your customers. As I apply it here, it posits that getting a few basic things right can go a long way. In poker, for instance, simply learning to fold your worst hands, bet your best ones, and make some effort to consider what your opponent holds will substantially mitigate your losses. If you are willing to do this, then perhaps 80% of the time you will be making the same decision as one of the best poker players like Duan, even if you have spent only 20% as much time studying the game. This relationship also holds in many other disciplines in which prediction is vital. The first 20% often begins with having the right data, the right technology, and the right incentives. You need to have some information, more of it rather than less, ideally, and you need to make sure that it is quality controlled. You need to have some familiarity with the tools of your trade. Having top-shelf technology is nice, but it's more important that you know how to use what you have. You need to care about accuracy, about getting at the objective truth, rather than about making the most pleasing or convenient prediction, or the one that might get you on television. Then you might progress to a few intermediate steps, developing some rules of thumb, heuristics, that are grounded in experience and common sense, and some systematic process to make a forecast, rather than doing so on an ad hoc basis. These things aren't exactly easy. Many people get them wrong. But they aren't hard either, and by doing them, you may be able to make predictions 80% as reliable as those of the world's foremost expert. Sometimes, however, it is not so much how good your predictions are in an absolute sense that matters, but how good they are relative to the competition. In poker, you can make 95% of your decisions correctly and still lose your shirt at a table full of players who are making the right move 99% of the time. Likewise, beating the stock market requires outpredicting teams of investors in fancy suits with MBAs from Ivy League schools who are paid seven-figure salaries and who have state-of-the-art computer systems at their disposal. In cases like these, it can require a lot of extra effort to beat the competition. You will find that you soon encounter diminishing returns. The extra experience that you gain, the further wrinkles that you add to your strategy, and the additional variables that you put into your forecasting model, these will only make a marginal difference. Meanwhile, the helpful rules of thumb that you developed, now you will need to learn the exceptions to them. However, when a field is highly competitive, it is only through this painstaking effort around the margin that you can make any money. There is a water level established by the competition, and your profit will be like the tip of an iceberg, a small sliver of competitive advantage floating just above the surface, but concealing a vast bulwark of effort that went in to support it. I've tried to avoid these sorts of areas. Instead, I've been fortunate enough to take advantage of fields where the water level was set pretty low, and getting the basics right counted for a lot. Baseball in the pre-Moneyball era used to be one of these. Billy Beane got an awful lot of mileage by recognizing a few simple things, like the fact that on-base percentage is a better measure of a player's offensive performance than his batting average. Nowadays, pretty much everyone realizes that. In politics, I'd expect that I'd have a small edge at best if there were a dozen clones of 538. But often I'm effectively competing against political pundits, like those on the McLaughlin group, who aren't really even trying to make accurate predictions. Poker was also this way in the mid-2000s. The steady influx of new and inexperienced players who thought they had learned how to play the game by watching TV kept the water level low. If you have strong analytical skills that might be applicable in a number of disciplines, it is very much worth considering the strength of the competition. It is often possible to make a profit by being pretty good at prediction in fields where the competition succumbs to poor incentives, bad habits, or blind adherence to tradition, or because you have better data or technology than they do. It is much harder to be very good in fields where everyone else is getting the basics right, and you may be fooling yourself if you think you have much of an edge. In general, society does need to make the extra effort at prediction, even though it may entail a lot of hard work with little immediate reward, or we need to be more aware that the approximations we make come with trade-offs. But if you're approaching prediction as more of a business proposition, you're usually better off finding some place where you can be the big fish in a small pond. The economics of the poker bubble. The Pareto principle of prediction implies that the worst forecasters, those who aren't getting even the first 20% right, are much worse than the best forecasters are good. Put another way, average forecasters are closer to the top than to the bottom of the pool. I'm sure that I'd lose a ton of money if I played poker against Juan, but I'd gladly play him if, as part of the deal, I were also guaranteed a match for the same stakes against some random person I picked off the street, against whom I'd expect to make back my losses and then some. We can test this hypothesis empirically by examining the statistical records of poker players. I evaluated the data from an online poker site, which consisted of a random sampling of no-limit hold'em players over a period in 2008 and 2009. These statistics told me how much money